Portraits of Blue and Gray, the Biographical Civil War Podcast. Episode 1, Robert E. Lee, Part 4. Look, General Lee, at the insurmountable difficulties between our line and that of the Yankees. The steep hills, the tiers of artillery, the fences, the heavy skirmish line. And then we'll have to fight our infantry against their batteries. Look at the ground we'll have to charge over. Nearly a mile of that open ground there under the rain of their canister and shrapnel. General James Longstreet spoke these cautionary words to Robert E. Lee in hopes of dissuading him from ordering the disastrous charge on July 3, 1863, the final day of Gettysburg. To his old war horse, Lee responded, "The enemy is there, General, and I am going to strike him." And so Pickett's charge proceeded to calamitous effect, marking a major turning point in the war. Southern revisionists would later lament, "If only Lee had listened to Longstreet, or if only Stonewall had still been alive." But as noted by Shelby Foote, the hard truth is Gettysburg was the price that the South paid for having Robert E. Lee as commander. Lee's aggressive fearlessness had served him and his cause well up till that point. However, just as excessive caution can become reticence or hesitation, abundant boldness can become recklessness. Yet despite the defeat, Lee's army managed to escape back to Virginia. President Lincoln and General-in-Chief Henry Halleck urged General George Meade to force further battle before Lee could cross the Potomac, but Meade favored caution. His half-hearted pursuit of Lee after the battle reminded Lincoln of, quote, "an old woman trying to shoo her geese across a creek," unquote. Now, in Meade's defense, his army, though victorious, had also been damaged at Gettysburg, and he had just witnessed the harm that could result from overaggression. Upon returning to Virginia, Lee offered his resignation to Jefferson Davis. He wrote to the president, quote, "No one is more aware than myself of my inability for the duties of my position. I cannot even accomplish what I myself desire. How can I fulfill the expectations of others?" Unquote. "Why not find a younger, healthier commander?" Lee suggested. And the stress of the continuous campaigns had taken its toll on Lee. His health was deteriorating to the point where he was forced on some days to ride in a wagon rather than leading the army atop traveler as he preferred. Now, of course, Davis wasn't having it. He was already struggling to find competent commanders in other theaters of the war. He knew he'd be hard-pressed to find a worthy replacement for Lee. There was simply no one else in whom Davis could place the trust of the army and the cause for which it fought. Welcome to Portraits of Blue and Gray. This is part 4 of episode 1, Robert E. Lee. In part 3, we saw Lee earn impressive victories at Fredericksburg and Chancellorsville before his defeat at Gettysburg. In part 4, we'll look at the final years of the war, Lee's surrender to Grant at Appomattox, and his postbellum life. This will be the final chapter in our portrait of Robert E. Lee. I certainly hope you have enjoyed it as much as I have. If you have any questions or comments about this or any other episode of the show, you can reach us at blueandgraypodcast@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. Or visit the show's site at portraitsofblueandgray.podbean.com. Please remember to rate us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or wherever else you might have found us. Thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoy the show. After the defeat at Gettysburg and the fall of Vicksburg, the Southern strategy had to change. Lee's plan to relieve the Western forces through Eastern pressure had failed, so instead Davis asked Lee to assume a defensive posture, allowing Longstreet to lead a significant portion of Lee's army to assist Braxton Bragg in Tennessee. Losing Longstreet and the men he took with him significantly added to the numbers disadvantage that the Army of Northern Virginia already faced, but Lee had little choice but to acquiesce despite his former objections to weakening Virginia's defenses. Still, Lee made sure to remind Longstreet that his presence was missed. After the Confederate victory at Chickamauga, due in no small part to the presence of Longstreet and his corps, Lee wrote to his old war horse, quote, "My whole heart and soul have been with you and your brave corps in your late battle. Finish the work before you and return to me," unquote. Lee's army had retreated deep into Virginia, south of the Rapidan River, while Meade camped at Culpeper, around 30 miles northwest of Fredericksburg. The rebels held a strong position and fortified entrenchments and planned to remain on the defensive until they had returned to full strength. But a purely defensive posture just wasn't in Lee's character. So in October 1863, upon learning that Meade's army was temporarily weakened by the transfer west of two corps, he decided on a plan to get around the Union right flank, between Meade and Washington. It was a similar plan to the one that had led to victory at Second Manassas the previous year. Generals Ewell and A.P. Hill would assume Stonewall Jackson's prior role, crossing the Rapidan for the flanking maneuver, while Jeb Stuart's cavalry harassed the Union army to disguise the movement. Stuart had apparently learned his lesson from Gettysburg. His absence there and the resulting lack of intelligence as to Union troop movements had proved costly. The plumed cavalry commander provided near-daily reports, leading the gray-bearded general to instruct a messenger from Stuart, quote, "Tell General Stuart to continue to press them back toward the river. But tell him, too, to spare his horses. It is not necessary to send so many messages. I think these two young gentlemen make 8 messengers sent me by General Stuart," unquote. And Lee's instructions to Stuart weren't born solely from his sympathy for the animals, though that undoubtedly played a part. The army was struggling to replace any lost horses and to feed those that remained. And a 19th century army relied heavily on its horses, and not just for the cavalry. Horses also transported the artillery and supplies. So a lost artillery or cavalry horse was as strategically damaging as a lost soldier, if not more so. So save your horses, General Stuart. But as for the plan to get around Meade's flank, the current commander of the Army of the Potomac was a bit more astute than Pope had been. He realized what Lee was up to and began withdrawing northeast up the Orange and Alexandria Railroad. A.P. Hill followed in pursuit, finally catching the Federal Army at Bristow Station near Broad Run. But rather than smashing the Bluecoats with a surprise flank assault, Hill found that he had walked into a trap laid for him by Union General Governor Warren. Hill's corps suffered 1,900 casualties, including a large number of officers, in what was one of the most disproportionate Confederate defeats of the war. In his official report on the encounter, Hill wrote, quote, "I am convinced that I made the attack too hastily. And at the same time, a delay of half an hour and there would have been no enemy to attack. In that event, I believe I should have equally blamed myself for not attacking at once," unquote. Yet despite the costly folly, Lee went easy on the temperamental Hill when the two observed the battlefield on the next day. "Well, well, General, bury these poor men and let us say no more about it." Meade had escaped, and there was nothing much that could be done about it. After the Union Army abandoned Culpeper, the town held a celebration in honor of Lee and his army. It was by all accounts a joyous occasion. The citizens were grateful for their temporary relief from Yankee occupation, as they saw it. But a local matron, speaking to the distinguished guest of honor, let be known her disapproval of several young ladies who had attended a social gathering hosted by Union General Sedgwick. They had been escorted by several young Union officers. Lee responded with a stern look toward the young women, which must have pleased their accuser. But then he presented a warm smile and friendly words of approval. "I know General Sedgwick very well. It is just like him to be so kindly and considerate, and to have his band there to entertain them. So, young ladies, if the music is good, go and hear it as often as you can, and enjoy yourselves. You will find that General Sedgwick will have none but agreeable gentlemen about him." As pleasant as the festivities in Culpeper must have been, with Meade having escaped, Lee was left with no choice but to withdraw back south of the Rapidan. The Union Army had devastated Prince William County as it pulled back, leaving little to no resources to sustain the advancing Confederates. One of Lee's staff officers commented, quote, As far as the eye can see, on every side there is one vast barren wilderness. Not a fence, not an acre cultivated, not a living object visible. And but for here and there a standing chimney on the ruins of what was once a handsome and happy home, one would imagine that man was never here, and that the country was an entirely new one without any virtue except its vast extent. Unquote. Even more, Meade had fallen back into a naturally defensible position, made more so by the entrenchments that the federal soldiers added to the Northern Virginia landscape. So attacking was more or less out of the question. Yet despite A.P. Hill's defeat at Bristow, the campaign could be viewed as a success. Though outnumbered 81,000 to 48,000, Lee had persuaded Meade to pull back a full 60 miles away from Richmond and toward Washington, which would seem to preclude another Union push on Richmond before the weather turned. And any future Union southward advance would be delayed by the damage inflicted on the railroads by both armies as they withdrew from the devastated region. Predictably, Lincoln was frustrated with Meade's retreat and the continuing delay. Of course, Meade maintained that he had been, and was still, looking for battle but couldn't find a suitable field due to the difficulties in precisely locating Lee. Halleck joined in the prodding of Meade, writing to the general, quote, "Lee is unquestionably bullying you. If you cannot ascertain his movements, I certainly cannot. If you pursue and fight him, I think you will find out where he is. I know of no other way." Unquote. Meade's response to this haranguing was, to paraphrase, "If you don't like the way I'm managing things, get somebody else." And he knew that was a bluff that Lincoln couldn't call, not at that point anyway. Replacing Meade only a few months after his Gettysburg victory would not go over well politically, and there really wasn't a suitable replacement available just then. So in his frustration, Lincoln privately remarked, quote, "What can I do with such generals as we have? Who among them is any better than Meade?" Unquote. But then in November, Meade decided to make one final push for 1863. The march was slow, only moving as fast as the work crews could repair the broken rail lines and bridges. Lee waited on the banks of the Rappahannock, in works that had previously been occupied by the Bluecoats. Meade had decided that it was his turn to test Lee's flank. He failed to turn the Confederates, but in repulsing the attack, Lee's army sustained more than double the casualties of Meade's and was forced to flee back across the Rapidan, back to where they had started. Overall, in the 2 months' fighting, Lee had lost around 4,000 men who he knew could not be replaced. In late November, Meade moved again, near the scene of the First Battle of Chancellorsville. Despite being outnumbered nearly 2-1, upon learning of the Union movements, Lee prepared for battle. He ordered his men to dig into the frozen ground, and they quickly prepared a line of entrenchments stretching almost 7 miles long along a ridge and providing for crisscrossing lines of fire. Many of the Union soldiers, when they observed the strength of the rebel position, pinned their names and addresses to their uniforms. They were convinced that the odds of surviving a direct assault on such forbidding defenses were not in their favor. They were reminded of the scene at Fredericksburg a year before. And like Burnside had done, Meade ordered an early morning attack. But, much to his men's relief, he canceled it after several corps commanders, notably including Governor Warren, suggested that the assault would be imprudent. When Lee realized Meade was not going to attack, he prepared for an early morning assault of his own on the Union right flank, which cavalryman Wade Hampton had reported was exposed. But when the attack began, the Yankees were already gone. Lee blamed himself for failing to capitalize on what he thought was a golden opportunity. "I am too old to command this army," he had lamented. "We should never have permitted these people to get away." And so the 1863 campaigns drew to an end when Meade withdrew north on December 1st. With regard to his final advance, Meade reported, quote, "I meant to go to Richmond if I could, but Lee's position was so strong that to storm it would have cost me 30,000 men. I could not remain without a battle. The weather was so cold that my sentinels froze to death on post," unquote. So both armies having gone to winter quarters, on December 9th, Jefferson Davis summoned Lee to a Richmond cabinet meeting for the purpose of selecting a new commander for the Army of Tennessee. Previously under Braxton Bragg, that army had suffered a recent severe setback at Chattanooga after which Bragg was relieved of command. The position was first offered to Longstreet and then General William Hardee, both of whom declined. Now Davis was of the mind to send Lee to North Georgia, where he would take command of, and hopefully salvage, the army that had been so recently whipped physically and psychologically by Ulysses Grant. Lee expressed to Davis that he would, of course, take the problematic command if ordered, but he did not have that confidence either in my strength or ability as would lead me at my own option to undertake the command in question. Lee suggested PGT Beauregard, who was still successfully heading up Charleston's defenses. But Davis had personal differences with Beauregard, and so it was decided that the command would go to Joseph Johnston, who Lee had taken over for after Seven Pines, and who was the pick of the majority of the cabinet and of the press, but who Davis thought was too inclined towards retreat. So Davis wasn't enthusiastic about appointing Johnston, but as so often seems to have been the case for both sides, there just weren't any better options. After the meeting, Lee stayed over in Richmond for a few days to inspect the city's defenses. He was welcomed throughout the city as something of a hero, receiving cheers wherever he went, including the House of Representatives and St. Paul's Cathedral. At St. Paul's, diarist and Richmond socialite Mary Chestnut, whose name you probably recognize if you've seen the Ken Burns Civil War program on PBS, noted that upon receiving a warm smile from Lee, quote, "I was ashamed at being so pleased. I blushed like a schoolgirl," unquote. So with his official duties in Richmond concluded, Lee opted against staying over for Christmas with his family. Instead, he resumed his duties with the Army of Northern Virginia on December 20th. The remainder of the winter passed in relative quiet. Then, in the spring of 1864, the Union Army began preparations for a campaign that was designed to bring the war to an abrupt conclusion. The ranks had been restored through the draft, and an abundance of ordnance and supplies were gathered in Washington. And perhaps most importantly, a new leader with a reputation as a fearless fighter had been summoned from the Western Theater. Ulysses Grant had been promoted to the rank of Lieutenant General, a promotion which required congressional action, and had been given command over all of the armies of the United States. Grant ordered simultaneous advances throughout the country, but he would personally oversee the Army of the Potomac's attack on Lee. So while Meade retained direct command, he would report to Grant and obey Grant's orders. Grant was cognizant of his significant advantages in both manpower and resources, and he wasn't afraid to use them. He also had the benefit of seasoned soldiers and the cooperation of the civil authorities, both of which his predecessors had sometimes lacked. And he viewed his objective differently than prior commanders. He wasn't really out to capture Richmond. He'd use it for leverage if he thought it would gain him an advantage, but what he was really intent on was Lee, specifically destroying Lee's army. With Lee out of the way, Richmond would have no choice but to surrender. And so Grant's orders to Meade were, quote, "Wherever Lee goes, there you shall go also," unquote. In May of 1864, Grant readied his force for the assault, which would be known as the Overland Campaign. He had about 140,000 men, well-fed and well-supplied, for the task of defeating Lee's 60,000. Grant's plan was to, quote, "hammer continuously against the armed force of the enemy and his resources, until, by mere attrition, if by nothing else, there should be nothing left of him but an equal submission with the loyal section of our common country to the Constitution and the laws," unquote. Beginning on May 4th, Grant crossed the Rapidan with the goal of circling around Lee's right flank. He crossed uncontested and anticipated that Lee would fall back and dig in to defend Richmond. Instead, Lee moved forward for battle. The two armies met at the Wilderness, near where General Hooker had been defeated a year earlier at Chancellorsville. When Grant learned of Lee's advance, he formed battle lines running northwest to southeast and ordered an attack. For 2 days, the two armies grappled in the thick undergrowth. Soldiers were unable to see more than 20 yards ahead, so they often had to rely on sound to aim their weapons. Then a brush fire that broke out on the second day increased the confusion. By the third day, Grant was ready to get out of the jungle-like terrain that partially negated his superior numbers in favor of more open country and a road to Richmond. Prior Union commanders would have withdrawn to recover after a battle that saw nearly 29,000 casualties. But Lee knew that Grant saw things differently. He remarked to a staff officer, quote, "General Grant is not going to retreat. He will move his army to Spotsylvania, General Grant's best strategic point," unquote. And Lee was correct. Grant intended to keep the pressure on and marched for Spotsylvania Courthouse. General John Gordon, who was close to Lee during the campaign, reported that Lee observed that, "If we could keep the Confederate Army between General Grant and Richmond, checking him for a few months longer, as we had in the past 2 days, some crisis in public affairs or change in public opinion in the North might induce the authorities in Washington to let the Southern states go." Stuart's cavalry impeded the Union movement, which allowed the rebels to outmarch the Federals and let Lee take a position at Spotsylvania Courthouse within earthworks in front of Grant's advance. But Grant would not be so easily discouraged. He ordered a dawn charge on a salient in the Confederate center, which became known as the Mule Shoe. The attack was initially successful. It resulted in around 3,000 Confederate prisoners, along with the capture of 18 artillery pieces, and forced a hole in the rebel center. Grant pressed his advantage, ordering attacks on Lee's left and right to prevent reinforcement of the broken center line. And this was the desperate scene that led to one of the most impressive demonstrations of Lee's leadership and courage. The gray-bearded general realized that his army was on the edge of disaster, and so he mounted Traveler and prepared to personally lead a charge to recover the lost position. Upon recognizing what Lee had in mind, Gordon seized the horse's reins. He said to Lee, but loud enough so that any nearby men could hear, "General Lee, this is no place for you. Go to the rear. These are Virginians and Georgians, sir, men who have never failed and who will not fail now." The men within earshot, and many who hadn't heard but who were able to gather what was going on, began shouting, "No, Lee to the rear! No, Lee to the rear!" Lee assented to his men's wishes and agreed to move back away from the intense fighting. But he had inspired them with his gameness. They weren't able to fully recover the lost position, but the five fierce charges they made in the effort delayed the Union advance sufficiently that the army was able to dig in and hold a new line. Shortly after the war ended, a Southern historian by the name of John Thompson Mason wrote to Lee requesting confirmation that this story was factual. Lee wrote back on December 7th, 1865, and I'm going to quote Lee's response in its entirety. Quote, "My dear sir, I regret that my occupations are such as to prevent me from writing at present a narrative of the event which you request in your letter of the 4th instant. The account you give is substantially correct. General Gordon was the officer. It occurred in the battles around Spotsylvania Courthouse. With great respect, your friend and servant, R. E. Lee." Unquote. Thus, Lee declined to participate in celebrating his own heroics, though neither did he offer any false modesty in disputing them. General Gordon would provide a harrowing description of the intense fighting at Spotsylvania. Quote, "Firing into one another's faces, beating one another down with clubbed muskets. The front ranks fought across the embankment's crest, almost within arm's reach, the men behind passing up to them freshly loaded rifles as their own were emptied. As those in front fell, others quickly sprang forward to take their places. On both sides, the dead were piled in heaps. Before the pelting hail and withering blast, the standing timber fell. The breastworks were literally drenched in blood." Unquote. Despite 32,000 combined casualties at Spotsylvania Courthouse, Grant again didn't pull back before implementing another plan to defeat Lee. His next move would be another attempt to maneuver around Lee's right flank, this time to take Hanover Junction, the important intersection of the Virginia Central and Richmond and Fredericksburg Railroads. Hanover Junction was also situated near the intersection of the North and South Anna Rivers. Grant believed that if he could take Hanover Junction, Richmond would be exposed from the north and northwest, and Lee would be forced to flee or to fight to defend the city. The Union Army reached the banks of the North Anna on May 23rd, where they found Lee's army on the south bank formed up in what appeared to be only a token resistance to the crossing, while the bulk of Lee's army withdrew. but which was in fact an attempt to lure Grant into splitting his army for destruction in detail. Grant nearly swallowed the bait. He ordered crossings at two fords a few miles to Lee's right and left, hoping to envelop and annihilate Lee's army. Lee responded by withdrawing his flanks and attacking straight ahead at Grant's center, where another Union crossing was now being attempted. Grant realized that he had nearly made a fatal mistake, and so he pulled back before Lee, who was ill at the time, could reel him in. Rather than further attempting to press Lee's position, Grant finally chose to pull back and regroup on the night of May 26th. Shortly after the action along the Anna River, Lee learned of a loss that hit him especially hard. Union Cavalry Commander Philip Sheridan, along with over 10,000 troopers, had attempted a raid on Richmond by circling wide around the Confederate right. Jeb Stuart was dispatched with about 4,500 horsemen to block Sheridan. The two cavalry forces met at Yellow Tavern, where the outmanned and outgunned Confederate cavalry was defeated, but the raid on Richmond was stalled. During the battle, Stuart drew attention to himself when he sought to rally his men. For his efforts, he received a life-threatening pistol shot from a dismounted Union private and died a few days later in Richmond, the loss of Stuart being the most significant result of the battle. Upon receiving word of Stuart's death, Lee asked to be left alone for a few minutes to collect his thoughts. The general had known Stuart since he had been a 19-year-old West Point cadet and Lee the school's superintendent. Stuart became a friend of the Lee family and had been with Robert at Harper's Ferry and through almost all of the present war. Eventually, a staff officer was forced to intrude on Lee's solitude. Before regaining his calm, poised manner, Lee remarked, "I can scarcely think of him without weeping." But Lee wouldn't have much time to mourn Stuart. Ulysses Grant would see to that. Grant again tried to get around Lee's right flank and again found Lee in his path, this time at a crossroads near present-day Mechanicsville, known as Cold Harbor, which H.W. Brands describes as being neither cold nor a harbor. The armies met about 10 miles northeast of Richmond. Both had received reinforcements, with Lee's coming from the troops assigned to protect Richmond itself. So the opposing forces there numbered about 59,000 Confederate to 108,000 Union. But the disparity wasn't as great as it sounds. Grant's reinforcements were primarily new recruits with little battlefield experience. Lee's, on the other hand, were battle-tested veterans already hardened in other theaters. And Lee's men occupied strong entrenchments. The fighting was going to commence in the same area as the Seven Days Battles of 1862. Some Union troops, when they were digging in, even found the remains of soldiers who had fallen 2 years earlier. Grant ordered a morning attack for June 1st. As a side note, for someone who was allegedly a drunk, Grant sure seems to have been a morning person, at least when it comes to scheduling assaults. We'll go into much greater detail in our next episode, but as something of a spoiler, Grant did have a taste for booze, but the stories of his drinking seem to have been seriously exaggerated by his political opponents, both during and after the war. Regardless, due to miscommunications, troops worn out from the prior night's marching, and some just plain old incompetence, the attack did not begin until after 6 in the evening, which allowed the rebels even more time to dig in. The delayed Union advance did push Lee's veterans back a little, but not enough to justify the 2,200 casualties sustained. Or at least that was the opinion of General Meade, who criticized Grant for attacking before he had sufficient intelligence on the Confederate positions and strength. Grant wanted to attack again on June 2nd, but delays in troop movements led to a one-day postponement. By the next morning, Lee had organized his army into a 7-mile-long curving line, protected on the left by the Totopotomoy Creek and on the right by the Chickahominy River. His flanks were well anchored, and his men occupied formidable entrenchments, but any Union breakthrough could be catastrophic because Lee lacked sufficient manpower to hold any reserves. So, when a Richmond politician visiting the army inquired about the amount of Lee's reserves, the rebel chieftain candidly answered, quote, "Not a regiment, and that has been my condition ever since the fighting commenced on the Rappahannock. If I shorten my lines to provide a reserve, he will turn me. If I weaken my lines to provide a reserve, he will break them," unquote. Lee's hope was that the strength of the battlements his men had prepared would make reserves unnecessary. All along the lines, they had constructed elaborate trench works and barricades that would expose any route of approach to concentrated artillery fire. A reporter observing the rebel position described it as intricate zigzagged lines within lines, lines protecting flanks of lines, lines built to enfilade an opposing line, works within works, and works without works. And this was exactly the kind of field that Lee needed to negate his adversary's numerical superiority. Nonetheless, Grant ordered a massive assault, which was once again on Lee's right, for June 3rd. The Union soldiers knew what they were in for, with many once again pinning their names and addresses to their uniforms to facilitate identification of their corpses after the battle. And given the situation, the June 3rd assault proceeded as might have been expected. There were 7,000 Union casualties to less than 1,500 Confederate, with nothing much gained. Unlike Burnside at Fredericksburg, when Grant saw the futility of further assaults, he reluctantly issued an order ending the attack. That evening he said, quote, "I regret this assault more than any one I have ever ordered," unquote. Meade, perhaps a little bitter over having to take orders from Grant after the Gettysburg victory, wrote, quote, "I think Grant has had his eyes opened and is willing to admit now that Virginia and Lee's army is not Tennessee and Bragg's army," unquote. The excessive casualties incurred during the Overland campaign earned Grant the label "fumbling butcher" in some newspapers and breathed new life into the Northern anti-war movement, which remained the last best hope the rebels had for achieving independence. It's probably unfair to say that unadulterated attrition, with no concern for his own losses, was the totality of Grant's strategy. I think Meade was partially correct to the extent that Grant did need to adjust his tactics to deal with a higher caliber opponent than what he had been dealing with out west. Historian James McPherson provides what I think is a really good insight into Grant's and Lee's competing strategies leading up to Cold Harbor. McPherson writes, quote, "From the outset, he had tried to maneuver Lee into open field combat, where Union superiority in numbers and firepower could cripple the enemy. It was Lee who turned it into a war of attrition by skillfully matching Grant's moves and confronting him with an entrenched defense at every turn. Although it galled Lee to yield the initiative to an opponent, his defensive strategy exacted two enemy casualties for every one of his own. That was a rate of attrition that might stun Northern voters into denying Lincoln re-election and ending the war. To avoid such a consequence, Grant had vowed to fight it out on the line if it took all summer," unquote. For more than a week after the heavy fighting of June 3rd, the two armies, now both entrenched, stood face to face, sometimes in positions only a few yards apart. There was no more full-on fighting at Cold Harbor, but artillery and snipers continued the mayhem. The men on both sides had been in or near combat zones for a month and were now exposed to life in the trenches that foreshadowed the horrors of the Western Front in World War I. Primary accounts suggest that PTSD was becoming a real problem on both sides. Generals Ewell and A.P. Hill had nervous episodes and had to be removed. Ewell would be permanently replaced by Jubal Early, though Hill was able to return to duty after getting some rest away from the front. Future Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr., who was then a 23-year-old captain in the 10th Massachusetts Infantry, wrote of the ordeal, quote, "Many a man has gone crazy since this campaign began from the terrible pressure on body and mind," unquote. Through all this, by all accounts, Lee remained the calm, steadying presence that held the exhausted rebel army together. All told, Cold Harbor resulted in 13,000 Union casualties compared to around 3,000 Confederate. The losses for the entire Overland campaign were more proportional, but still favored the rebels 52,000 to 33,000. But again, Grant was in much better position to absorb these losses, as they represented a smaller proportion of his total force. Grant had also permanently wrestled the initiative away from Lee. The Army of Northern Virginia was now forced to defend Richmond from within entrenchments and would never again go on the offensive. But even so, Grant recognized that it was time for a strategy adjustment. Rather than continuing to take heavy losses attacking fortified positions, he would attempt to cut Lee and Richmond off from their supply lines. So he directed General David Hunter to obstruct the transit of supplies from the Shenandoah Valley and Sheridan and his cavalry were tasked with the destruction of the Virginia Central Railroad. Meade would pull out of Cold Harbor and move on Petersburg, which was a crucial Confederate railway junction to the south of Richmond. Beginning July 12th, Grant moved his army, again around Lee's right, and crossed the James River on his way to Petersburg. Petersburg was defended by around 2,500 Southerners, manning extensive entrenchments and commanded by Brigadier General Henry Wise, who was a former governor of Virginia. The defenders included the Home Guard, which consisted mostly of teenagers and old men who the Confederates had armed in their desperation. A small Union force of about 4,500 men initially approached Petersburg and found some success until their advance was halted by the arrival of Beauregard with reinforcements from Richmond itself. The second attempt came on June 15th, when around 16,000 men under Brigadier General William Baldy Smith followed the same route as the first attempt. Beauregard later noted that, quote, "At this hour, Petersburg was clearly at the mercy of the federal commander, who had all but captured it," unquote. However, Smith's delay, which was uncharacteristically deferred to by Winfield Scott Hancock, allowed Beauregard to reallocate forces from another position, bringing his defensive line to 14,000. Fierce but inconclusive fighting continued on June 16th and 17th. Beauregard pleaded for reinforcements, but Lee believed that Richmond, and not Petersburg, was Grant's primary target, and so he only provided Beauregard with 6,000 men. This left a little over 20,000 entrenched Southerners defending against around 65,000 Union troops. On June 18th, Lee realized that Petersburg was Grant's objective, and he assumed direct command of the city's defenses. The Union Army continuously attacked the Petersburg defenses and continued to take heavy losses, but could not manage a breakthrough. The 4 days' fighting had thus far resulted in around 11,000 Union casualties to 4,000 Confederate. Grant was facing public outcry over the high casualty counts, and so he decided to halt any further direct attacks on the entrenchments in favor of laying a siege. For nearly 10 months, Lee's army resisted, but little chance of victory remained. Grant continued to receive a steady stream of reinforcements. Lee had little hope of receiving any more men. He must have been aware how dire the situation had become, but by all accounts, Lee maintained a brave face, knowing that his force was viewed as the Confederacy's last hope, however long the chances. Lee attempted to relieve some of the pressure by sending General Jubal Early on a cavalry raid into the Shenandoah Valley, but Early would ultimately be defeated by Sheridan's superior forces at Cedar Creek, though Early did reach within 5 miles of Washington and effectively burned down the town of Chambersburg, Pennsylvania, in alleged retaliation for Sheridan's total destruction of the Shenandoah Valley. Grant tried to shorten the siege by sending cavalry expeditions to destroy southern railroads and threaten Richmond, but those were also initially unsuccessful. A novel plan to blow up Confederate entrenchments with underground explosives in advance of an infantry assault was successful in opening a temporary hole in the defensive line and killing about 300 rebels in the explosion. But the infantrymen that made the subsequent assault advanced into the crater formed by the explosion instead of around it, and ended up as easy targets when the Confederates formed up infantry and artillery to respond. They were, in effect, fish in the proverbial barrel. The Battle of the Crater resulted in around 4,000 Union casualties to around 1,500 Confederate, and was an episode that Grant referred to as the saddest affair I have witnessed in the war. Then, in September of 1864, a Confederate force about 4,000 strong snuck out of Petersburg, circled around the Union position, and seized about 2,500 beef cattle, previously the property of the Army of the Potomac. Undoubtedly, the cattle must have been a beautiful sight to the besieged, half-starved rebels, who Richmond could no longer feed. God knows there's not much better than a hamburger when you're surviving on quarter rations. However, the stolen cattle would represent the last bright spot for the Confederates defending Petersburg. During the fall and winter, desertion was rampant in Lee's army. Lee reported to Richmond that hundreds of men were deserting nightly, never to be replaced. The scene a few miles away in Richmond wasn't much rosier. Political infighting and an apparent loss of confidence in Jefferson Davis led some Richmond politicians to call for Davis to step down, to be replaced by Lee in the role of dictator, as in ancient Rome. Instead of opting for dictatorship, the Confederate Congress created a new position of general-in-chief, to which Davis appointed Lee. But to the extent that having Lee instead of Davis in charge of all Confederate military affairs could have altered the ultimate outcome, which is speculative at best, doubtful at worst, his appointment had come far too late to make any meaningful difference. Over the winter, Lee also advocated on behalf of another bill that had been introduced in Richmond and would have allowed for the arming of slaves. In a letter to Congress in support of the measure, Lee wrote that the law was, quote, "not only expedient, but necessary. The Negroes, under proper circumstances, will make efficient soldiers. I think we could at least do as well with them as the enemy. Those who were employed should be freed. It would be neither just nor wise to require them to serve as slaves," unquote. Though the bill would ultimately pass, for his efforts, Lee's status as a good Southerner was questioned by the Richmond Examiner. But once again, the change in policy was too little too late. By March 1865, Lee realized that he had no choice but to abandon Petersburg and Richmond, sacrificing the capital in hopes of saving the army. And so he ordered a breakout attempt. His design was to blow a hole through the center of the Union lines that the army could escape through. They would then head south and join up with General Joseph Johnston for a combined attack on Sherman in the Carolinas. The breakout nearly succeeded. A gap was initially opened, but rallying Union troops were able to close it before it could be exploited. And even worse for Lee, assigning troops to the breakout had weakened his defenses elsewhere. Grant didn't waste any time pursuing the advantage. He rarely did. And the subsequent Union counterassault succeeded in capturing parts of Lee's picket line southwest of Petersburg. After the failed breakout, Grant prepared for an all-out assault on April 2, 1865. The weakened Confederate positions were overrun, and Lee pulled out of Petersburg and Richmond that night, hoping to unite what remained of his army with Johnston or escape to the mountains of western Virginia. As the lines were breaking, Lee reportedly said to one of his subordinates, "Well, Colonel, it has happened as I told them it would at Richmond. The line has been stretched until it has broken." So Petersburg fell on April 2, 1865, and Lee suffered the loss of another corps commander when A.P. Hill was killed in that day's fighting. Overall, Grant's Petersburg campaign had resulted in an estimated 42,000 Union casualties to 28,000 Confederate. On April 7th of 1865, Grant, in hot pursuit of Lee, sent a note for the purpose of suggesting a surrender. Grant wrote, quote, "The result of the last week must convince you of the hopelessness of further resistance on the part of the Army of Northern Virginia in this struggle. I feel that it is so, and regard it as my duty to shift from myself the responsibility of any further effusion of blood by asking of you the surrender of that portion of the Confederate Southern Army known as the Army of Northern Virginia. Very respectfully, your obedient servant, U.S. Grant," unquote. Lee provided a response the same day, stating that he disagreed with Grant's description of the hopelessness, but that, "I reciprocate your desire to avoid useless effusion of blood." Lee would not propose terms himself, but he was willing to listen. So the following day, Grant responded, quote, "Peace being my first desire, there is but one condition that I insist upon, that the men surrounded shall be disqualified for taking up arms again against the government of the United States until properly exchanged," unquote. So Grant proposed that the two generals meet between the lines for the purpose of discussing the terms of surrender. Grant's rise to national prominence had begun when he insisted upon unconditional surrender as the only acceptable terms for the surrender of Fort Donelson, but the hard-bargaining Grant was much more conciliatory with Lee. Lee again responded on the same day, writing, "I did not intend to propose surrender, but to ask the terms of your proposition." So Lee would not meet for the purpose of discussing surrender, but he would meet with Grant, quote, "at 10 a.m. tomorrow on the stage road to Richmond between the picket lines of the two armies," unquote. So Lee had held out as long as he could, but he was becoming resigned to the fate of the army. They were nearly surrounded and outnumbered 6-1. An aide suggested ordering the army to melt away into the woods and continue fighting as guerrillas, but Lee dismissed the suggestion. In such a situation, the men, quote, "would become mere bands of marauders, and the enemy's cavalry would pursue them and overrun many sections they may never have occasion to visit. We would bring on a state of affairs it would take the country years to recover from. There is nothing left but to go to General Grant, and I would rather die 1,000 deaths," unquote. Another staff officer questioned Lee as to what history would think of their surrender if any chance of escape yet remained. Lee's response demonstrates respectable leadership qualities. Quote, "They will not understand our situation, but that is not the question. The question is whether it is right, and if it is right, I take the responsibility." Unquote. So Lee wasn't concerned with whether his decision would be viewed favorably by posterity. He was concerned with whether he was making the right decision. Either way, his army couldn't break free. High water and a lack of provisions made escape practically impossible, and any efforts in that regard would have amounted to an exercise in futility and a waste of life. So with no realistic alternatives remaining, Lee requested a meeting with Grant, who, in turn, ordered that further federal movements cease and the two meet in a farmhouse at Appomattox Courthouse. The terms of surrender were as Grant had said. The rebels would turn over their arms and artillery and agree not to take up arms against the United States. In return, they, quote, would be allowed to return to their homes, not be disturbed by the United States authority so long as they observe their parole and the laws in force where they may reside, unquote. The Civil War, for all intents and purposes, was over. Lee, of course, had little choice but to accept whatever terms Grant had offered. Yet Grant offered terms that allowed both Lee and his men to save face, and that would prevent future prosecution of rebel soldiers for treason. Grant even acceded to Lee's request that Southern soldiers and officers be permitted to take with them any horses that they personally owned. Retaining their horses would allow them to put in a crop to carry themselves and their families through the next winter. The Confederate general forever remembered and appreciated Grant's consideration. For the duration of his life, Lee would not permit others to speak ill of General Grant in his presence without correction. And of course, among the Southerners with whom Lee chiefly spoke, ill words for General Grant were not uncommon. So after the surrender had been finalized, Grant introduced Lee to his staff. Among them was Eli Parker, who was a Seneca Indian. Upon shaking Parker's hand and noting his ancestry, Lee remarked, quote, "I am glad to see one real American here," unquote, to which Parker famously responded, "We are all Americans." When speaking to his men after the surrender, Lee got emotional. He was nearly in tears, and all he could say was, "We have fought through the war together. I have done the best I could for you. My heart is too full to say more." But the following day, Lee issued a very heartfelt written address which thanked his soldiers for their service. He was then escorted to Richmond by a detachment of federal cavalry. After the war, Lee avoided public life, but privately he took a stance in favor of conciliation. He disapproved of the efforts of some of his former subordinates, most notably Jubal Early, to foment resentment and talks of renewing the struggle in the future. When he was asked for his thoughts on Early's efforts, Lee said, quote, "I think all topics or questions calculated to excite angry discussion or hostile feelings should be avoided," unquote. And Lee once remarked to a woman who had expressed bitterness towards the Yankees after losing her husband in the war, quote, "Madam, do not train up your children in hostility to the government of the United States. Remember that we are one country now. Dismiss from your mind all sectional feelings and bring them up to be Americans," unquote. The London Standard summarized Lee's post-war activities as follows, quote, "He carefully abstained from appearing in any public ceremony or taking any overt part in political questions. His influence has been exerted, quietly but steadily, in one direction, with a single view to restore harmony and goodwill between the two sections," unquote. In October of 1865, about 6 months after the war ended, Lee became the president of Washington College in Lexington, Virginia, which was and is also the home of the Virginia Military Institute. Lee would reside there in Lexington for the remainder of his years. Washington College, of course, is still around today, but is now known as Washington and Lee University. A professor at the college during Lee's time wrote of Lee, quote, "The students fairly worshipped him and deeply dreaded his displeasure. Yet so kind, affable, and gentle was he toward them that all loved to approach him. No student would have dared to violate General Lee's expressed wish or appeal. If he had done so, the students themselves would have driven him from the college," unquote. In March of 1866, Lee was summoned to testify before the Congressional Reconstruction Committee. He was asked why he had fought for the Confederacy, and he responded that his view was, quote, that the act of Virginia in withdrawing herself from the United States carried me along as a citizen of Virginia, and that her laws and her acts were binding on me. He believed that the positions of the two sections, which they held to each other, was brought about by the politicians of the country, that the great masses of people, if they understood the real question, would have avoided it. And on the question of secession itself, Lee stated that, I did believe at the time that it was an unnecessary condition of affairs and might have been avoided if forbearance and wisdom had been practiced on both sides. Lee testified that he supported educating and extending civil rights to freed slaves, and he did in fact lead an effort to establish state-funded schools for former slaves, but he did not support enfranchising them, at least until they had been educated. In 1869, the former Confederate chieftain visited the White House at then-President Grant's invitation. The gesture from both men was viewed as being symbolic of the nation's reconciliation. However, during the prior year's election, Lee had endorsed the Democratic candidate Horatio Seymour, though Lee himself was not eligible to vote. Then, in October of 1870, a little more than 5 years after the end of the war, Lee suffered a stroke and then died soon thereafter. He was buried at Lee Chapel at Washington and Lee, and memorials were held throughout the South and even some in the North, with eulogies by many of his former men and officers and by Jefferson Davis. Admiring obituaries for Lee were even run by several English newspapers. The Pall Mall Gazette, for example, wrote, quote, His public career ended, he passed away from men's thoughts. And few in Europe cared to inquire the fate of the general whose exploits had aroused the wonder of neutrals and belligerents, and whose noble character had excited the admiration of even the most bitter of his political enemies. If, however, success is not always to be accounted as the sole foundation of renown, General Lee's life and career deserve to be held in reverence by all who admire the talents of a general and the noblest qualities of a soldier. Ambition for him had no charms. Duty alone was his guide. His simplicity of life checked luxury in display among officers, while his disregard of hardships silenced the murmurs of his soldiery. It is said that during 4 years of war he never slept in a house, but in winter and summer shared the hardships of his soldiers. When political animosity has calmed down, and when Americans can look back on those years of war with feelings unbiased by party strife, then will General Lee's character be appreciated by all his countrymen as it now is by a part, and his name will be honored as that of one of the noblest soldiers who have ever drawn a sword. Unquote. Somewhat paradoxically, Lee was, after his death, to a certain degree mythologized by the Lost Cause movement, which James McPherson says, quote, took on the proportions of heroic legend with Robert E. Lee as a latter-day Siegfried. Unquote. Now, I say paradoxically because the modest General Lee favored reconciliation and would almost certainly not have approved of being associated with that movement or with its lionization of him. Lee has been commemorated immeasurably, including on postage stamps and by having barracks at West Point and roads, bridges, parks, and schools throughout the South named after him. And of course, the famous Dodge Charger featured in the Dukes of Hazzard was known as the General Lee. Lee's military tactics continue to be studied, though his overall strategy is sometimes criticized. The chief critique is that Lee's offensive-mindedness and aggression negated some of the natural advantages he would have otherwise enjoyed as a defender. The counterargument to that assessment is that defensive-minded Confederate generals such as Joseph Johnston did not achieve nearly the level of success as Lee. Foreign intervention and reduced Northern public support were viewed as the best chances for success, and Lee's victories came the closest to making both of those happen. And continued Southern public support relied upon minimizing Union occupation. In states like Kentucky and Missouri, which were occupied early in the war, the level of public support was significantly lower than in states controlled by the Confederacy. And whenever a region was occupied, its resources were all but lost to the rebel armies. So keeping the Yankees out was an important goal, politically and militarily, and that couldn't be accomplished through guerrilla warfare alone or from the entrenchments around Richmond. But then, of course, as Shelby Foote noted, the cost for Lee's aggression was paid at Gettysburg. HistoryNet ranks Lee as one of the top 100 generals in world history. In 1861, Winfield Scott estimated that the loss of Lee from the U.S. Army was worth 20,000 soldiers. In retrospect, Scott's figure seems low. To consider Lee's value to the Confederacy, contemplate how the rebels might have fared without him. In baseball terms, what was Lee's war, or wins above replacement? Without question, Lee compares favorably with most other Confederate commanders who might have stood in his place. For example, you could reasonably argue that had Joseph Johnston retained command in 1861, that there's a strong chance that McClellan would have been able to lay siege to Richmond, which would have almost certainly resulted in a shorter war. Or had Lee taken the Union command as Winfield Scott wanted and employed his offensive-minded approach with superior numbers, it may have been a very short war indeed. But that's not what happened. Lee chose to follow Virginia, and as one of the many results, he lost his status as a United States citizen. President Andrew Johnson's 1865 amnesty order pardoned ex-Confederates, but specifically excluded high-ranking politicians and military officers. And so, during his life, Lee never received a pardon or an official restoration of citizenship, though he did sign the amnesty oath and submit a special application to Grant. But then, in 1975, over 100 years after his death, and after several years of efforts led by Senator Harry Byrd of Virginia, the United States Congress passed a resolution posthumously restoring Lee's citizenship, effective as of the day his application had been submitted to Grant. As if in confirmation of the Pall Mall Gazette's prediction 100 years earlier, at the signing ceremony, President Gerald Ford, who was born in Nebraska and grew up in Michigan, remarked, "General Lee's character has been an example to succeeding generations, making the restoration of his citizenship an event in which every American can take pride." And that will bring a close to our portrait of Robert E. Lee. Thank you for listening, for all the support the show has already received. Now that we've completed our look at the life of a Southern hero, we're going to turn to a Northern one. So we hope you'll join us next time when we begin our look at the life of Union General and future President Ulysses S. Grant. If you would like to contact Portraits of Blue and Gray, you can reach us by email at blueandgraypodcast@gmail.com. Questions and comments are welcome from Yankees and secesh alike. And remember, we always spell Gray the old-fashioned way, G-R-E-Y. Visit the show's webpage at portraitsofblueandgray.podbeam.com. If you enjoyed the show and want to contribute financially, click on the Become a Patron badge at the top of the main page to visit our crowdfunding page. Or visit that page directly at patreon.podbeam.com/blueandgray. All contributors are wholeheartedly appreciated and will be thanked by name in an upcoming episode, unless you ask us not to. Please rate and review the show on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or whichever other app you used to find us. Thanks for listening, and we hope you'll join us again soon.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pile-ups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.